Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 58, verses for today, 30 to 38. And because we don't have much time now, what we'll do is chant all of the verses together. Okay, so chapter, verse 30.
विन्द्यानुविन्द्यावावन्त्यौ दुर्योधनवशानुगौ स्वयंवरे स्वभगिनीं कृष्णे सत्तां न शेधताम्.
Translation: Vindhya and Anuvindhya, who shared the throne of Avanti, were followers of Duryodhan. When the time came for their sister Mitravinda to select her husband in the Swayamvar ceremony, they forbade her to choose Krishna, although she was attracted to him. Purport: The feelings of enmity between the Kurus and the Pandavas were so strong that Mitravinda's brothers, out of friendship for Duryodhan, forbade the young maiden to accept Krishna as her husband. Text 31.
राजादिदेव्यास्तनयां मित्रविन्दां पितृश्वशुः वसय्य रतवान् कृष्णो राजन् राज्ञां प्रपश्यताम्.
Translation: My dear king, Lord Krishna forcibly took away Princess Mitravinda, the daughter of his aunt Rajadi Devi, before the eyes of the rival kings. 32.
नाग्नजिन्नाम कौशल्य आसीत् राजाति धार्मिकः तस्य सत्याभवत् कन्या देवी नाग्नजितेन्द्रप.
O king, Nagnajit, the very pious king of Kaushalya, had a lovely daughter named Satya or Nagnajiti. Text 33.
नतां शेकुर्नृपावोढुम् अजित्वा सप्तगो वृषान् तीक्ष्ण श्रृंगान् सुदुर्दर्शान् वीर्य गंधा सहान खलान.
The kings who came as suitors were not allowed to marry her unless they could subdue 7 sharp-horned bulls. These bulls were extremely vicious and uncontrollable, and they could not tolerate even the smell of warriors. Text 34.
तं श्रुत्वा विषजिल्लभ्यां भगवान् सात्वतां पतिः जगाम कौशल्यपुरं सैन्येन महता वृतः.
When the supreme personality of Godhead, the master of the Vaishnavas, heard of the princess who was to be won by the conqueror of the bulls, he went to the capital of Kaushalya with a large army. Text 35.
स्वकौशलपतिः प्रीतः प्रत्युत्थानासनादिभिः अर्हेणेनापि गुरुणा पूजयन् प्रतिनन्दितः.
The king of Kaushala, pleased to see Lord Krishna, worshipped him by rising from his throne and offering him a seat of honor and substantial gifts. Lord Krishna also greeted the king respectfully. Text 36. This one seems to be a different meter.
Varam milokya bhimatam samagatam narendra kanya chakame ramapatim bhuyadayam me patirashishonalah karotu satya yadime dhrito vratah.
When the king's daughter saw that most agreeable suitor arrived, she immediately desired to have him, the lord of goddess Rama. She prayed, "May he become my husband. If I have kept my vows, may the sacred fire bring about the fulfillment of my hopes." Text 37. This is a different meter.
Yat pada pankajaraja shirasa bibharti shri rabjaja sagirisha sahaloka palai lila tanu swa kritasetu paripsayayah काले दधस भगवान ममते नतुष्ये.
Translation: Goddess Lakshmi, Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and the rulers of the various planets placed the dust of his lotus feet on their heads and to protect the codes of religion which he has created, he assumes pastime incarnations at various times. How may that Supreme Personality of Godhead become pleased with me? Text 38.
Architam punaritiyaha narayana jagatpate atmanandena purnasya karamani himalupakaha.
King Nagnajit first worshipped the Lord properly and then addressed him. O Narayan, Lord of the universe, you are full in your own spiritual pleasure. Therefore, what can this insignificant person do for you?
Om Agnayati Miram Visvajanam Yanishvakaya Chakshuram Miritam Yanakasmai Shri Guruvayanam.
So today I divided my talk into two parts. In the first part, I will talk about why we believe these pastimes, that these pastimes are real, they represent reality. And then in the second pastime, I want to present Sanatan Goswami Pad's commentary on these verses, if you have time. So, to orient those who came in late, this chapter describes the marriage between Krishna and five princes. Krishna had eight principal queens, or has eight principal queens, and I want to invite the students to guess or tell me the names of these eight principal queens. Rukmini,
Rukmini.
Yes?
Satyabhama.
Yes. Okay, so you have as bad a memory as I do, so I'm going to read the names. Rukmini Jambavati, Satyabhama, Kalindi, Mitravinda, Nagnajiti, Lakshmana and Bhadra. Three of these, the marriage of Krishna to three of these queens already has been described in the past times before. Satyabhama, Rukmini and Jambavati. And now the rest of the five, this chapter covers Krishna's marriage, wedding to these five princes. And Mitravinda is Mitravinda and Nagnajiti, these are the two that we discussed today. So what is happening here? Mitravinda is the princess of Avanti. Avanti is modern day Ujjain, it's in Madhya Pradesh in India. And she wants to marry Krishna, but her brothers are envious and they don't want her to do that. So Krishna comes and forcibly, you could say, abducts her, and then they get married. So that's the first. And then the second one is Nagnajiti, who's the daughter of King Nagnajit. So now to come to the question of why we as Vaishnavas accept these pastimes as real. Now why do I raise that question? We all have read about the handsome knight in shining armor fighting the dragons and rescuing the princess from some dark dungeon. She's been kidnapped by this dragon. There are so many fairy tales that we hear where the hero fights. He's a hero. He has great military prowess and he fights and defeats these dragons or bad elements and rescues the princess and marries. So are these fairy tales? Then Krishna is a hero and we have these queens that have been, and there are many stories like this. Rukmini's marriage to Krishna was the same way. She wrote a letter to Krishna and then Krishna came, and in the middle of all the warriors, he's described like a lion takes his prey from the jackals, in the midst of jackals he takes. So how do we, I find myself personally, it's useful for me to remind myself why I am in this in the first place. To go back to the origins of how I started, to reflect and question ourselves, our beliefs, where are they coming from, why am I in this. So, and I do this a lot. Remind myself. Now, I remember here outside, was meeting a young man. He's an Indian, well-educated, you would say. He probably had a PhD or something. Rational, analytical mind, or so he thinks. And he started chatting. And he said, well, you know, you believe this Bhagavad Gita. I could believe in Mein Kampf. I could believe in the Egyptian scrolls. I could believe in whatever I wanted. You can believe in anything. What's the point? What's the use? So I don't know if kids know what Mein Kampf is, but I'm sure the adults know. You do? Good. So equating the Bhagavad Gita with Mein Kampf is monstrosity. It's difficult to hear such things. But he was a guest, and so I answered in a way that I thought was reasonable. So I wanted to answer that question, really, why? And the answer for me, and I think the answer differs for different people, but maybe what I have to say is of use to some. And the answer for me was that it's a question of identity. Now, why do people believe in physics textbooks? Nobody asks her, why do you believe in physics textbooks? Or why do you pick up that chemistry textbook and say, yeah, that's correct? Because it has some qualities, that knowledge. It is reasonable, it is verifiable, and it is attested to by authorities, right? The scientific authorities attest to it. Yeah, that's true. It's the distilled information that we have after trial and error measurements and theories in the current modern day understanding of the world. And it has results, verifiable results. What are the results? Well, we have technology, we have the electricity in this room, we have aeroplanes that fly and cars that work and satellites that allow cell phones to work. So the proof is in the pudding. We can apply the same metrics to Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Is it reasonable? Is it verifiable? Is it attested to by authorities? Does it produce results? If you read books on dragons or Harry Potter, which is the modern day version of this, sorry to hear. I always pick on Harry Potter. I apologize. I should find somebody else. But anyway, for now, Harry Potter, he also fights, I'm sure he fights all kinds of things. Three-headed dogs and trees and who are alive and throwing stones at him and so on. Reading Harry Potter doesn't create a transformation in the heart. It doesn't cause material passions and desires to subside. It doesn't purify us. We experience, when we read the Bhagavatam, we experience purification, a cessation of frustration, lamentation, hankering, peace. Fiction doesn't bring peace. Krishna's pastimes are not fiction. And this is a case of fiction following fact. Krishna's pastimes are fact, and fiction derives inspiration from his pastimes. It's the other way around. But coming back to this question, well, why pursue, when we have physics and chemistry and math and biology, why pursue knowledge of the Bhagavatam? Because none of these books tell us who we are. The question of identity is not settled. So, the way I view it, I am like a person who is shopping. And people think that this is a question of faith, but this is not a question of faith. We don't believe these things. At least from my point of view, I'm not in this because of faith. This is not the way people think faith is, dogmatic process. The reason I'm in it is because I made a choice. There's a difference between a choice and faith. So I want to explain that by explaining the choice that a shopper makes. Let's say we go to a computer store, I want to buy a computer. So the modern day shopper, he looks at the statistics of individual brands, customer reviews, specifications, price, and then he makes the best decision possible with the information available to him. When he makes the decision to buy a computer, it does not imply that it's a faith-based choice. He makes the decision based on information that's available. And then he's well aware that the choice could be wrong, that the computer might fail, because there's always a failure rate. And he's fully aware of that, and yet he makes the choice, because the choice has to be made. It is necessary. He's shopping for a computer. In the same way, I am shopping in the marketplace of ideas of the world for an answer to the question, who am I? If I go to the scientific physics, chemistry, biology books, the answer is that I am atoms. That means I am dirt. That means I don't exist. Nothing exists. There is no perceiver. There is nothing that's perceived. Nobody, none of these people in this room, according to modern day science, which is the topmost knowledge we have, nobody exists. Relationships don't exist. There's no such thing as love. There is no such thing as truth. And there is no such thing as untruth. Richard Dawkins, a famous atheist, he says, well, why can't you just appreciate the garden for its beauty? Why do you have to look for a fairy under the bottom of it? Okay, but who is perceiving the garden? And who is looking for a fairy? Why does it matter what truth is and what untruth is? Why are the scientists and the atheists so concerned about my dogmatic beliefs in fairy tales? Doesn't make any sense. Because ultimately, nothing matters. It's only... See, the trouble with this philosophy of materialism, of the lack of a soul, is the fact that everybody, including the atheist, when he opens his mouth to say anything, he makes the a priori assumption that it matters what he says. But if he believes this philosophy, then he doesn't matter. It's just energy, sound waves in air, and who's perceiving it? Why the obsession with truth? So if you're going to make the assumption that you matter, then you have to be something more than matter. It's a fait accompli. There is no option but to choose that we are not matter. Because if I am just a programmed robot, a molecular robot, then it doesn't really matter what I believe, what I choose to believe. So I'm going to make the conscious choice. I don't like the product A, that's present in the scientific worldview of things, that I'm matter alone. I'm a shopper, and I don't buy it. I don't like it. So what am I going to do? I look into this marketplace of spiritual ideas, and there I'm given a reason to exist. There they say, no, you exist. Don't believe the scientists. You matter, because you are not matter alone. Okay, so now I'm thinking, all right, I like that concept, and I'm going to choose to accept that. It may be wrong, but what do I have to lose other than my own non-existence? Okay, so I'll theoretically accept that I may be more than matter, and then love matters. Love takes on a meaning. Relationships take on a meaning. I have a purpose in life. And if I lived in vain, so be it. What does it matter anyway? Now the question comes, well, what about the Mein Kampf versus the Bhagavad Gita or Harry Potter? I touched upon it, that those don't bring about transformations in the heart. But even if somebody said, oh, that's hocus pocus, that's just bogus, the main question is, the philosophy, this product, the Bhagavad Gita, in the marketplace of ideas, what does it tell me about the world? Does it help me rationalize, come up with rational explanations, logical justifications for what happens in my experience? Because there is the Bible, there is the Quran, there is the Torah, there is the Buddha, there are so many gems. So what should I believe? But none of these thought systems, if you will, allow the concept of reincarnation. None of these allow me an explanation for why a two-year-old will die of cancer. The world seems intrinsically unfair. If I am spirit and not matter, the world is designed in an unfair way and God can't be just. God is unfair. Cruel. So it is not satisfactory to me, at least, that these different other products, spiritual products out there, offer the answers. They say that there is no such thing as rebirth, then I cannot explain the injustice that's in this world. I cannot explain rationalize why I am suffering. So because of that, again, it's a fait accompli. I don't really have a choice. The Bhagavad Gita is the only thing that's there. Then the question is, well, what about these pastimes? Seems like fiction. But there is a process to approach these pastimes. Process has to be followed. The product has specifications. There is a manual. We have to read the manual on how to actually use the product. If the product is 110 volts, and we plug it into a 220 volt power outlet, you are burning the product off. You are destroying it. So there is a process to accept, to not accept, but to evaluate and use the product. So this process has to do with satam prasangan mama virya samvido bhavanti rutkarna kasavasayana katha. The topics of Krishna have to be heard in the presence of devotees from the realized devotees. Then they are not fairy tales anymore. Yeah, but the atheist will respond, again, that's brainwashing. You just come together as a group, you believe your thing, you talk to each other, and you convince each other, and you discuss some more, and you convince each other more about complete untruths. But there is a problem with that argument. There are two problems with it. The first problem is that the acharyas that we follow were geniuses. And I think any person who evaluates them neutrally will see that these are not ordinary people. Jiva Goswami, Rupa Goswami, Sanatana Goswami, going back, Sridhar Swami, Srila Prabhupada. At the age of 70, the way that Prabhupada answered questions and destroyed challenges, speaks to his intelligence, rays of sharp intelligence, his genius. These people are geniuses. If you look at the commentaries of Madhvacharya, the intricate analysis, logical argumentation. These people are not so easy, they're not dull, they're not just brainwashed people. But they're just going to accept everything and everything under the sun in the name of religion. The second problem with it is that our acharyas emphatically claim that they have realized God. Sanatan Goswami, one of our acharyas, he met God and he took direct instruction from him. Now, like Prabhupada used to say, whether you believe it or not is your business. But this is the claim. We claim that our Vaishnava acharya, they directly spoke Krishna, the source of all creation. Similarly, Srila Prabhupada spoke with God. We all know his boat journey on Jalaguta where Krishna personally came. Oh, these are just some delusions or lies. Well, they're not. Because it's unreasonable to say that on one hand, a person like Srila Prabhupada is so practical, who managed such a large organization, who wrote such intricate philosophy and argued so forcefully and logically for concepts, thought systems, who had such a lofty character, and all our acharyas are like that, who had nothing to do with the material world, who had no material desires left, that he would lie, it just seems out of character. That he would concoct, make something up to impress somebody else when the person has no material desires left. How do we know that? Look at his renunciation. He sacrificed his life, took great risk to take that journey. It is out of character, it doesn't add up to say that these people are concocting or lying to influence or persuade large mass audience to become, to attract power and followers. And so it is with Sanatana Goswami and Rupa Goswami, who wore a loincloth and lived and slept under different trees. What did they have to do with the world? With adulation, with cheating others. So that doesn't add up. We reject the claim that these are falsities because it is out of character for the people. Compared to the people who make the allegation that the Bhagavad Gita is mind calm, or who make the allegation that our acharyas are pretenders or deluded, who have no character whatsoever. And this is why character is so important. Who is speaking is very important. Who is giving the knowledge? It's critical. Okay, so that's my ranting against the alternative view. The conclusion I would draw is we live in a parallel reality. We don't live, or at least that's the program. When we come to the temple, we step into a parallel reality. It's not the material world. And that's why things don't square up with the material world, but we don't care. Because we made the conscious choice to be in this world and not in the material world. So in the time I have left, which is about 3 minutes, let's see if I can do justice to Sanatana Goswami, Goswami's commentary. I chose this verse. Actually, he makes commentaries on each of his verses. They are deeply revealing. One thing I will point out, he says, he explains why Nagmajit, what the word Nagmajit means. So I'll read this Sanskrit here. I never understood why that, what, where that came from. Adidharmikah Shri Bhagavad Dharma Para iti arthaha ata eva nagnan jainan api jayati swavashe karoti iti Nagmajit. What that means is that in this verse, text, text 32. Raja Atidharmikaha. Atidharmikaha is translated here religious, very religious. Sanatana Goswami Pada explains that word as Shri Bhagavad Dharma Para, Vaishnava. Bhagavad Dharma Para, one who is completely surrendered to this question of dharma, that's the Nagmajit. And because he was that, atayeva, therefore, Nagnan Jainan, the Jains are atheists in India. Nagnan, they are naked, they walk naked. Nagnan Jainanapi Jayati, he could defeat even these atheists. And that's why his name is Nagmajit. So that's the meaning of the word Nagmajit. Nagmajit. Okay. So coming to verse 37, beautiful words. Yatpad pangajaraja shirasa vibharti shri rabjajah sagirishah sarlokapalaihi lila tanuhu svakrata setu paripsayayah kale dadhat sa bhagavan namakena kushya. This reminds me of another verse which I want to chant because I like it very much, which is in the 11th canto. Everybody recognizes it. Bheyam sada paribhavagnam abhisht doham Tirthaspadam Shivavirinchinutam Sharanyam Rityatiham Pranatapala Bhavavipotam Mande Mahapurushati Charanarindam. I heard this verse for the first time when I was hearing a recording of Srila Prabhupada in his last days, and an Indian visitor came to meet him. And he offered his obeisances by singing this verse. I was thinking, oh, where is this verse? So I looked it up on the internet, that's how I found it. And he was calling Srila Prabhupada, Vande Mahapurushate Charanarvindam. He was offering his respectful obeisances, calling Prabhupada Mahapurusha. That verse is for Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Dheyam Sada, always we should meditate on the lotus feet of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which destroys all the inconveniences of this material world. Paribhavagnam, this material disease, nam, destroys it. And then the next one is Tirthaspadam. Is the refuge of all the holy places, and Prabhupada also includes all the holy people, sadhus, his feet, lotus feet. Shiva Virinchinutam. Shiva and Virin and Brahma, Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma, they offer obeisances at those lotus feet. And this is what's being said here. It's kind of really the same thing. Even the meter is the same. Yat Pada Pankaja Raja Shirasa Abhidharti. Shri Lakshmi Abja. Abja is lotus, Abja Jaha, born of the lotus. The Lord Brahma and Girish, Giri is mountain, Isha is controller, so the Lord of the mountains, that's Shiva. They take the dust of the lotus feet of Krishna onto their heads. Saha Lokapalahi. Sanatana Goswami Pada explains that Lokapal here refers to Indra and all the other demigods. They take the dust of the feet of Krishna's feet on their heads. And then it's interesting here, I couldn't understand this sentence till I read this. Lila tanuhu swakrita setu paripsayaya. Then it goes into it seems like a tangent, that he created the codes of religion, and to protect it he performs leela, pastimes. And how will this Lord become pleased with me? That's the overall construction of this verse. So Sanatana Goswami Prabhupada explains, this also goes to saying this is not a fairy tale, because the acharyas derive such depth of meaning. They show us how deep these verses are. Each verse, I mean, this verse, Sanatana Goswami Prabhupada has written a whole page on it, just this verse. So how is it? You can't do that with Harry Potter or even Shakespeare. There is a logic, a rationale for everything in these verses. It's beyond human calculation. So here what he's saying is the sequence, he's explaining the sequence. Why is Lakshmi mentioned first, then Brahma, then Shiva, and then the demigods? Sanatana Goswami explains. It's because of the level of intimacy. The most intimate is Lakshmi. Then the sun, Brahma. So because of affection from the sun, his name is mentioned. Brahma's friend is Lord Shiva. So his name is mentioned. And then Krishna, Bibharti, he sustains these different demigods, and so they are mentioned. So it's a hierarchy, that's how the sequence is, of affection. So what Nagnajiti, Satya, she is praying is that these great souls, Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, Lakshmi, they take the dust off the feet of Krishna. Why? Because they have great devotion. And she mentions, according to Sanatana Goswami Prabhupada, here, Shri Adaya Yasya Tatha Bhaktin Kurvanti Tad Bhakto Koham Iti Bhava. These great souls, the way they do perform devotional service to Krishna, how can I do that? I can't. That's what they're being mentioned. She's expressing her dainya, her humility, that these are far, far greater personalities, far greater devotees than I am. And even they, she mentions, that's why Leela is mentioned here. Even they cannot participate in Krishna's leelas. Even they cannot get the dust of Krishna's feet so easily. Right? Even they want that dust. Advaitacharya is an example. Advaitacharya is Lord Shiva. He wants the dust of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's feet. But Mahaprabhu doesn't let him do that, because Mahaprabhu treats him as his guru, and he takes instead the dust of Advaitacharya's feet. This is true. So even for them, it's very difficult to get the dust of Krishna's feet on their heads. And then why is this mentioned, Parikshaya? Why codes of religion being mentioned? She says, because I am fallen, according to Sanatana Goswami Prabhupada. I am fallen. I have transgressed. Swadharma maryada atikramena bhakti adhikara nasti. I don't have any right on Krishna, on bhakti, because I have transgressed the codes of religion. And Krishna is coming to establish the codes of religion. And so she's asking, well, kena tushyet, how can I satisfy him? It's an extreme sense of dainya bhav. Humility is the wrong word, I don't know what it is, what the English word is. Where she is expressing her deep desperation for Krishna. Expressing her lack of devotion, her transgression of dharma. I don't know how that's possible, but anyway, that's her sentiment. So this is what Sanatana Goswami Prabhupada explains this verse. And it's a long commentary and we don't have any time. So I'm going to close here, and then if any questions or comments, you're welcome. Hare Krishna. Question at the back. Sesha Prabhu first.
Thank you, Hare Krishna, for sharing a little bit of class. I think that in addition to your analysis of why we believe that, to complete that, you have to go more into the heart. You mentioned heart, changing the heart very little. But most of it was strength of intelligence and mind, and defeating arguments. but there are experiences, direct experiences of love for Krishna and Krishna's presence in one's life that can't be explained solely by an intellectual or a mental explanation of why we believe. And I think that another time, another place, that needs to be explored and added to what you've described here. Because certainly we may meet a very powerful, intelligent, brilliant mind, and if all we have to guard our people of devotion is our own mind and intelligence, we may be defeated, and we may have to accept that defeat if we remain on that platform only. But if we have an actual experience of the presence of Krishna, which comes, as you know, with the marvelous state of development of love of God, yet intervention in our lives by the Supreme Lord, then, despite whatever intellect we meet, we won't be moved. That'll be another irrationality that materialists have to deal with. And it's part of the
function. Thank you. Anybody on the lady side? Ladies have any questions?
I think interesting. So you were saying earlier that you accept this process rather than aristocracy person. Basically because it's coming from the authority, the line of authority is coming from the Lord himself, to the authority and system. Whereas in the scientific circle, knowledge is you're experimenting and finding stuff, but because it's all based on sense deception and the extension of that, it's still very limited, very, very limited. And amidst that, really, there's so much assumption and so much theories, see? That's misdirecting the world and misleading it. And the scientists, even though they may seem logical and rational, but because they're off, everything they've done is actually zeros. They're never accepting the supreme control or the supreme being. Whatever their findings are, it still becomes zero here. They're still challenging, and they're still misleading constantly. They're misleading the whole world, the thinking of life. Came from primordial soup, and they're, when a big bang is the origin of the universe, and it's a demonic mentality in a so-called world jugglery world. So for us to accept that that sort, it's not enough for us. That's why we are accepting what we are.
Thank you. Anyone else? Thank you very much. Thank you.